Hello, everyone, and welcome to Common Sense Conversations with the Alliance for Gun Responsibility. We are really hoping that these conversations can give our community an opportunity to learn more about the important work that we're doing and our partners and elected officials that are doing it right along with us. We were also hoping that we'd be able to start this series full of hope and determination for this new year. But we're having this conversation the day after a group of domestic terrorists stormed the US Capitol in a violent attack on our democracy. And closer to home, a group of pro-Trump protesters, some armed, stormed onto the lawn of the governor's mansion in Olympia. I'm really glad that our first guests are two of our strongest champions in the legislature, Senator Jamie Peterson and Representative Drew Hansen. Thank you both so much for taking time to chat today. I want to start by giving you both the opportunity just to respond to the events of the last couple of days. How are you feeling and how are you thinking about this as we move on?
Well, I mean, look, like I have said now publicly that Speaker Pelosi should give Vice President Pence and the cabinet a 5 p.m. deadline to invoke the 25th Amendment. And if that is not done, then they should pass impeachment articles of impeachment out of the House tonight and get them over to the Senate for a conviction vote tomorrow, since it has long been obvious that President Trump is unfit to govern a chicken coop, much less this presidency. That is a different question from encouraging sedition, which he obviously has. And, you know, it needs to be gone. That doesn't end the accountability for what happens yesterday, but that would be a very useful first step to remove the powers of pardon and the powers to make nuclear war from this bizarre, deranged person who currently occupies the Oval Office.
I can't say I disagree with anything that Representative Hansen said. I guess I've been in a very reflective mode. It seems like there are so many things that have happened here in the last 12 months that we thought could never happen. Mm-hmm. Our creativity or our sense of the possible is expanding and expanding. And I guess in that sense, trying to have some more optimistic spin on it, I'm hopeful that some of the constraints that we put on ourselves about what's pragmatically doable maybe can be taken down just for purposes of imagining. And we can think about what it really might mean for us to create a set of laws that are just and equitable for everybody in our society, and kind of reimagine how we want the world to be sort of freed of the walls that we've built for ourselves. I don't have a lot of confidence that anything's going to happen in the next 13 days to interrupt the final days of the Trump administration. But on the other hand, it does seem clear that his malfeasance over the last couple months paved the way for a U.S. Senate majority that probably otherwise would not have happened. And then that's exciting to think about what possibilities that opens up over the next 2 years and beyond.
Yeah, when we get 60 votes for background checks. Joking.
The nice thing is 50 votes can make the decision, and there are consequences for that, but 50 votes could make the decision, or 51 with the vice president can make the decision to end the filibuster and restructure the way that the Senate does business.
Yeah.
I'm with you. And that'd be the first thing that I would do. I'm just worried. I mean, on the other hand, Senator Manchin is the co-author of Manchin Toomey. So perhaps that is something he can somehow wrangle a bunch of votes for. So in any event, Renee, over to the state level.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I'm wondering, this just sort of for both of you, I like that framework, Senator, in terms of sort of releasing ourselves from constraints and getting more creative. Do either of you have thoughts about, clearly we can think about that at the federal level, but at the local level or the state level, do you have thoughts about in the gun violence prevention space, what that could potentially mean?
Well, look, I think you guys have been leading a lot of the creativity, honestly. You know, we started, it's worth pausing and remembering that 8 years ago, we lived in a state where the conventional wisdom was that we couldn't pass anything over the objection of the NRA, and that the voters were firmly against us, and we had to move very tentatively at the margins. We have now been in a period since the passage of Initiative 594, in a period of extended dialogue between the legislature and the people on this issue. And I think each time we ask the questions, we find out that people are ready for us to do more, right? And so, you know, in along those lines, you know, we're queued up to pass the restrictions that the great state of Alabama has already imposed on protesters and on having armed protesters, probably for some different reasons than the Alabama legislature took action. We're also, I think, going to have a really.
When did they take action on that, Jamie?
What's
is
that?
Is that like a Reconstruction bill?
Yeah, I think it's a 1960s like civil rights era bill, I think.
Yeah. Definitely different rationale.
Definitely a different rationale, but you know, hey, if the model is helpful. And you know, I think we can have a really serious conversation this session about high capacity magazines and whether we're in a position where we can just ban those going forward. Obviously, the integrated background check system that Representative Hansen led the fight on is on its way to being implemented in our state. And that's gonna, our big bets so far have been about making background checks work. And so to the extent that we can really beef up that system and make it have fewer errors, that's gonna be a benefit for everybody. You know, but I think in the longer term, we've got to think, our society is very different now from what it was in 1889. Like what is it that we want gun ownership to look like? If we're gonna have a continued constitutional right for owning guns, is it reasonable, with given how lethal they've become, for them to be freely available to everybody with just a background check, but without any training, without any licensing or sort of oversight? I don't know. I think those are the kinds of questions that we need to start asking.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, I feel like on the policy front, some of the creativity and expanding of possibility is in finding possible solutions to people getting killed by firearms that are not the standard list, you know, high capacity magazines, assault weapons, you know, whatever it is, right? And it's not, nothing's wrong with the standard list, right? But one thing that we learned through a couple of bills that I did with Republican members of the legislature is that when you get outside of the standard list, there's a lot of bipartisan progress you can make because positions are not hardened. And so to take, you know, two examples, one was the centralized background, single point of contact background check system that Senator Peterson mentioned. That was NRA supported and was a bipartisan bill from beginning to end, including putting a fee on the new background checks to fund the system.
Well, that part wasn't quite as bipartisan.
Still got votes, but it was all in one bill, and the bill passed with bipartisan majorities. And the NRA, you know, would they prefer not to have the fee? Of course, right? But they didn't pull their support of the bill because of the fee. Similarly, a bill that I did some years ago with Representative Dave Hayes that requires reports to local law enforcement when someone tries to buy a gun and does a background check so that there can be some follow-up is still showing results. I mean, we get the report on that every December, and sure enough, we are in fact catching people who unquestionably should not have a firearm, who knowingly, illegally attempted to buy a firearm and imposing some consequences on them. That bill came about in no small part because of gun owners in my district who suggested something like that as a solution. So, you know, look, I mean, stuff like that's difficult to come up with, but the exciting part of it is it allows you to move forward on in really quite significant public safety ways without having the usual bloodbath over a gun bill. And I mean, that's exciting for me, and I think exciting for all of us, but not to, and I think, like, look, the difficulty is, in the as a practical matter, the high capacity magazine bill is going to be a bloodbath. I would vote for it. I voted for it out of committee last time. We are not even discussing a ban on further semi-automatic long gun sales in this state. I would vote for that, but I guarantee you that we're not discussing it because that would also be a bloodbath. And so, you know, look, like I think those are constraints that no amount of imagination or hopeful optimism are going to make go away. Then again, sex ed was a bloodbath too, right? We passed comprehensive, scientifically accurate sexual education. The minority party in the House, at least, you would think that we were proposing like broiling infants. I mean, it was just like the worst thing ever. Like, you know, they're saying God bless America in the caucus room and then came out and spent the entire night debating it. But you know what? It was okay. We passed it. There was a referendum. It failed. And now the completely sensible policy of comprehensive, medically accurate, age-appropriate sex education with parental opt-out rights is law in Washington. So we're gonna have to pay the price of the pain. But I'm hopeful that if we pay the price of the pain on some of these sensible policy issues like high capacity magazines, it will be over and then they will be law and fewer people will die, which is what we're all doing this for.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I mean, you know, we're trying to stop literal bloodbaths in our streets. And so some bloodbaths in the legislature to make sure we can move things forward might be necessary. And
Figuratively,
please, yes, totally, figuratively. So we've talked some about policy, both past and what we're hoping to look at this this session. We'll dig into that a little bit more. But before we do, I wanted to get both of your sort of sense and reflection on what you're expecting out of this, what will be a very unusual session. We know there are going to be constraints because we're not going to be able to be in person. It will be primarily virtual. And would just love to hear from each of you how you think that's going to impact the work in each of your chambers.
Yeah, so I guess I can go first on this one. We're gonna have, we're calling it a hybrid, although in point of fact, there are gonna be very few people on the floor and mostly the same sort of crew of people with maybe one or two folks rotating in according onto the floor according to the topics that are being debated on any particular day. We did our first full Senate practice Zoom yesterday. What a disaster. It's going to be very, very clunky. It took almost an hour for staff to get everybody admitted to the Zoom call and cleared and try to get the technology worked out, and still lots of bugs. Committees are going to be in both chambers fully virtual. So if you start with the optimistic or hopeful part, I would say the potential for much broader participation and for us to hear voices that we normally couldn't hear, whether that's people who have to work or have kids or for whatever reason can't make it to Olympia for an 8 a.m. or a 10 a.m. hearing. We're gonna have the ability to have those people on a Zoom call from the comfort of their home or their office and able to participate in the conversation that we're having about these policies. So I would say that's gonna be one of the positives about the session. The House and sorry to point fingers, Drew, but you know, the House made, I think, what is the most consequential decision of the 2021 session, which is that they're not going to amend their rules to allow them to cut off debate. And given the way that their minority party behaves, what I suspect that means is that there is going to be an extremely small number of controversial bills that can pass out of the House, whether it's in the first half on House bills or in the second half on Senate bills. I mean, I think we're really talking about maybe 10 to 12, maybe 15 bills total that could pass. And included in that, you have to take the budget, any revenue bill, a transportation package if there is one, all the police accountability stuff, climate change. I mean, so, you know, that's we're coming close to using up the whole budget of what you can have a long floor debate on. And the House Republicans over time have really learned that if they exercise their filibuster rights on things that they don't like, that they can kill a lot of other things that they don't like, that they don't have the votes to stop. So I just predict that under the current House rules, that is likely to be the fate of the large majority of bills that get introduced this session. And an awful lot of stuff is going to have to wait for 2022. So maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's what I'm most worried about in terms of our ability to advance the kind of agenda that we ought to be able to, given the majorities that the people of the state of Washington elected and sent to Olympia.
So I won't defend the extent of debate that we typically have when we discuss draft House rules. I wanted to make a motion to apply the 3-minute rule to all debate. For those who don't know, that allows a maximum of 3 minutes per speaker on an amendment or final passage. And because, you know, honestly, like, when Twitter's 280 characters, you can't do your thing in 3 minutes, like, you probably got problems. But the, you know, look, the, I think, so although that is a constraint, one constraint that is removed is the expectation that we pass a lot of stupid bills, both out of committee and off the floor. I mean, every year we have some volume of bills, in the House at least, that are unquestionably not urgent, not, you know, they may make minor improvements to some piece of policy. And that is good if you believe that politics is, with Max Weber, the slow boring of hard boards, but it may not be the most important work that we have to do, akin to these blockbuster pieces of legislation. So for member management reasons, we are going to have to pass a bunch of bills that are not the blockbuster pieces of legislation, but I'm hopeful that there will be fewer of them. And I think at least, you know, our leadership has given pretty clear direction that something has to be both urgent and related to COVID, the economic recovery, racial equity, or climate, and something that is not going to cost a bunch of money, given the budget constraint, and something that has been well worked in advance. And look, I mean, should those filters always be on us? I actually don't think the subject matter filter should, and I pushed back against that, but was unsuccessful. But, you know, generally, like, those process-based filters are appropriate ones. And so I'm hopeful that if early in the committee process, we start managing expectations and telling people on both sides of the aisle, look, stuff that would move in another year is not happening this year, we will free up enough floor space to pass more blockbuster pieces of legislation, maybe not what we would ordinarily do in a lawn session, but, you know, look, even in an ordinary lawn session, it's kind of a miracle if we pass 5 enormous bills, policy bills, besides the budget. So I don't know. I mean, I think I haven't lost hope entirely that we'll be able to do some big things this year.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. We haven't lost hope either, but I also know that we're very cognizant of the challenges that this session will put forward. Senator, you spoke earlier just in passing about open carry, and want to just dig into that a little bit more as a policy area. To talk through sort of, you know, given what we're seeing happen across the country and definitely in our own state, why you think this is an important piece of legislation. And I know both of you, we've had conversations about this, and how you think that conversation could go this session.
Yeah, so I am someone who acknowledges that after the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Heller 11 years ago, we apparently have a Second Amendment individual right to bear arms. And that was already clear from Article 1, Section 24 of the state constitution. Where I think we are in developing that jurisprudence is very early still, right? Mm-hmm. By contrast, we have 200 years of cases about free speech and free assembly. And we understand that there has to be some balancing of interests. the protest, how these things collide is that I don't think there can be any reasonable question about the idea that when you've got one group of people protesting who come armed with semi-automatic weapons, it is going to chill the ability of other people to exercise their rights to assemble and to speak, particularly to express a different point of view. And so I think part of the very natural process of working out the scope of the constitutional right to bear arms is to figure out how we can make that work consistently with protecting other critical and cherished constitutional rights, particularly those around political expression, political speech. And it seems clear to me after the experiences that we've had over the past year that we're not currently in a good balance. And we need to do something about making sure that everyone feels safe expressing political points of view and coming into the public square. And I guess I would just say to cap that off, there is no more obvious public square than the Capitol campus in Olympia in our state. And to the extent that you've got one group of people behaving in a way that makes the other 7 million people who live in our state feel unsafe, uncomfortable coming to the Capitol campus, that's a problem. We had a long caucus meeting on Tuesday before the events of yesterday, talking about the threat by the three percenters to keep us, you know, blockade us out of the building or to try to breach the building, which, you know, seemed a lot more far-fetched then than it does now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're talking about legislators feeling threatened and uncomfortable coming to Olympia. How do you think that a young mom who wants to come and express her view on public schools is going to feel about bringing kids down to Olympia? It's just not tolerable that we would allow that kind of situation to persist around the core of our democracy.
Yeah, or a survivor of gun violence.
Or absolutely. A survivor
of gun violence. Yeah. Yeah.
Of domestic violence, or yeah, you know,
absolutely
add to the list. Like it's that is not, we don't have the right balance right now.
Representative Hansen, do you want to add anything to the open carry conversation?
No, I mean, look, my understanding is that bill is going to begin in the Senate, and I will hear whatever version of that bill comes out of the Senate with the intention of swiftly moving it forward. And if we have to kill a bunch of other bills, like the uniform recontextualization of something, no offense, Senator, then that's what we're gonna do. But we're not. We're gonna pass all of what we lovingly refer to as the Eat Your Spinach, Jamie Peterson bills.
Broccoli.
Oh.
Broccoli, I do prefer broccoli.
Well, gentlemen, before I let you go, I wanna ask each of you, a two-part question. One, the first part being, what in the gun violence prevention space are you most proud of having accomplished so far in your working so closely with us and with your, you know, constituents from not just in your districts but across the state to make sure that we have safer communities? And then two, what will you define as a successful session in terms of gun violence prevention for this year?
Drew, you want to start?
Sure. I mean, look, I'm proudest of this multi-year bipartisan effort to strengthen background checks. I mean, Renee is one of about three people who understands what a big deal this is. I mean, I think if you had talked to gun violence prevention advocates a decade ago about this, they would have said, well, that'd be amazing, right? If we could get centralized strong background checks, never gonna happen. There's no possibility it's ever gonna happen. Frankly, when law enforcement talked to senior staff people in the executive branch a year ago, they said, never gonna happen. So I am delighted that this massive public safety improvement that is going to keep a lot of guns out of the hands of dangerous people and save a lot of lives, and that everyone thought was politically impossible, actually was not. So I'm very, very proud of that. I mean, I think in terms of the success metric, look, I mean, I don't see us losing ground on anything we've done, whether it's on that or something else from a fiscal perspective. I would like to see, I mean, I think meaningful action on the world of intimidation at demonstrations and political speech and political spaces would be about the highest priority in a world where the constitutionality of the high capacity magazine ban is at the federal level is at least in question. I haven't read closely enough the district court's decision or the current bill to know how much daylight there is. But, you know, like right now we got a panel decision in the Ninth Circuit with a petition for in-bank review pending, striking down California's high capacity magazine ban. So, you know, I'll look more closely at this question, but that is an obstacle. And so something around this question about intimidation at demonstrations and political speech and political places would be tremendous to get done, if for nothing else, to make sure that people feel that they're able to participate freely in our democracy without intimidation or threat.
Great, thank you.
And I guess just taking a slightly longer view, I think back to the bill that I ran in the 2013 session in the wake of Sandy Hook to try to get universal background checks done, and where we were and the, you know, sort of frustration of having no more than 48 votes in the House, let alone a path in the Senate to get anything done, and the distance that we have come for the Alliance since then, we are making steady and significant progress. And so that's something I think to be very proud of, a big accomplishment and a testament to what people can do when you get them activated and caring. You know, I know in those days, the conventional wisdom was that the NRA could fill a packet hearing room on a moment's notice, and that although there was broad support for gun responsibility, that it was an inch deep and you couldn't actually get anybody to contribute money or to volunteer or do anything for campaigns. That conventional wisdom has been flipped on its head. And I think that's directly related to the success of the agenda over the last few years, and very satisfying to see how much progress we've made. I'm a little more optimistic than Representative Hansen is that we're gonna be able to figure out how to do high capacity magazines in a way that will be different from what the California Assembly did and be constitutionally defensible. Now, who knows if that winds up in front of Justice Coney Barrett, we're probably sunk, but I think that there's a way to do some meaningful restrictions on devices that frankly have no place in a civilized society. Like, their only purpose is to increase the destruction of human beings. And I think we'll be able to do good work in terms of the protecting people's right safely to assemble and speak and protest. So, you know, those are some of my hopes for what's likely to be a very challenging session.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for your work in this space and for really being dedicated to keeping our communities as safe from gun violence as we possibly can. We look forward to what will be a very interesting and hopefully productive session, and really appreciate your time. So thank you both.
Thank you.